Хочешь, Джузеппе Мария? Io sapevo che saresti venuto tu. Dio mio, quanto sei bello. Ma perché te ne vai? Non te ne andare, no? E posso parlare, sì? Dio, che consolazione. Bello, bello, santo mio, bello, che felicità, che gioia. Io lo sapevo che saresti venuto. Gesù, Giuseppe, Mario. Bello, santo mio.
When we think of censors in movies, we usually think of sex and violence. Well, The Miracle was censored, but it has no sex, no violence. So what was the problem? Sacrilege. The content and the theme of The Miracle was shocking in 1950 to many Catholics. I'd like to tell you that it shocked other people too, but apparently it didn't. But those Catholics who were shocked were so outraged that they demanded the movie be banned. And they were successful. The Miracle was made in 1948 under the title Il Miracolo by the famous Italian director Roberto Rossellini from a script by his good friend Federico Fellini. It starred Italy's most beloved actress, Anna Magnani. It tells the story of a demented peasant woman, a goat herder. In the first scene, we see her tending her goats along a trail high on a hilltop of the Italian coast. A bearded man appears. He's hiking past her, and she becomes infatuated with this stranger, so much so that she won't let him go. She convinces herself that he is actually her favorite saint, Saint Joseph. Now he, recognizing an easy mark in this simple, deluded woman, plies her with wine, and just as her inhibitions loosen, the screen fades to black. We see nothing. A few scenes later, the woman is playing with some children down in the village. We see that she is as childlike as they are. She faints. And when the village women rush to help her, they realize she's pregnant. She has no idea, and she tells them that it must be the child of Saint Joseph. And you can imagine their reaction to that. The villagers ridicule her, mocking her misguided belief, and she runs away, wandering the mountains alone. When it's her time, she starts back for the village, but then realizes that she can't go back there. With nowhere else to turn, she and one of her goats go back up into the hills and make their way to a deserted mountaintop church where she gives birth to a son. Was the miracle meant to be sacrilegious? In 1950, that would become a burning question in New York City. Now let me tell you the story of what happened to this movie. It was passed by the Italian censors, and the Vatican showed no particular concern. It opened around Italy to a pretty lukewarm reception. It didn't even make back its paltry production budget. So Rossellini arranged to have it shown at the Venice Film Festival, hoping someone would buy the distribution rights so he could at least make his money back. And that's where the hero of our story, Joseph Burstyn, comes in. Burstyn was a small-time but highly regarded independent foreign film importer based in New York City. Burstyn had seen the movie at Venice and fell in love with it. He decided to buy the U.S. distribution rights, and he brought it home and dutifully submitted it to the New York Censor Board. Now, I need to back up just a bit here and tell you that in 1950, New York State had been censoring all movies shown commercially within the state's borders for 28 years. No one was paying much attention to this, what many of us today would consider an obviously unconstitutional interference with free speech and artistic expression. But in 1950, there were a lot more pressing issues, like the Cold War, which was rapidly warming, the Soviets with an atomic bomb, the Korean War, reports of internal communism, economic problems. A lot of what was going on in 1950 was not good news. So it shouldn't surprise us particularly that the work of the movie censors of New York was going unnoticed. Incidentally, there were movie censor boards in five other states and hundreds of towns and cities. They'd started in the progressive era at the turn of the century when people first became worried about movie content. And most of these censor boards continued well into the 1950s, some into the 1960s, and the state of Maryland continued right up into 1981. In New York, the censor board was officially called the Motion Picture Division, and it was housed in the State Education Department. These censors reviewed The Miracle and gave it a license. No problem, no issues. Burstyn now had a legally viewable film. Now, the movie is only 40 minutes long and wouldn't work as a feature film. So Burstyn took two other shorter-length films he had hanging around, looked for a common theme, saw that they all dealt in one way or another with love, and put the films together as a sort of triptych. He titled the compilation Ways of Love. Now here's where Burstyn might have gone wrong, might have been actually asking for trouble. He decided to introduce each short film with a different dictionary definition of the word love. The definition he used for the Miracle segment was ardent affection, passionate attachment, man's adoration of God, sexual passion, gratification. Whether Burstyn thought about the juxtaposition of man's adoration of God with sexual passion and how that might offend Catholics, we'll probably never know. But it's easy to see today how Catholics might construe this as blasphemous. Burstyn again applied for a license from the Motion Picture Division for Ways of Love, and again he got one, and no problem. He booked the movie for late December at New York City's premier art house, the Paris Theater on West 58th Street, and then set back to wait for reviews. Now here we need to go back to Rossellini for just a minute. One of the reasons he'd made this movie in 1948 was as a vehicle to show off the acting talents of Anna Magnani, who was his lover. Shortly after making The Miracle with Magnani, he met and fell in love with Ingrid Bergman, the married Ingrid Bergman. When she left her husband and her child to have Rossellini's baby, it became a major international scandal. You see, Bergman had often played nuns in some of America's favorite movies, like The Bells of St. Mary's, and she was considered something of America's sweetheart, an all-around good girl, and America's favorite movie nun. So when word of her affair with Rossellini got out, it upset many American Catholics. 1950 was not a good time for any Rossellini film to be premiering in America. But Burstyn didn't care. He loved the movie, and that was all that mattered to him. He'd spent the past 20 years bringing only the finest European films to American theaters, convinced that Americans needed and deserved to be exposed to the movies of European directors. That was his life's mission. And by the time he brought The Miracle to New York, Burstyn had already won Best Foreign Film of the Year 3 years running. So what was going on between Bergman and Rossellini was of no concern to Burstyn. He just wanted Americans to see The Miracle, and he thought he could make some money in the process. After all, he was a businessman. So let's set the stage here for the premiere of this movie. Its title is The Miracle. It's opening during the Christmas season. It has a potentially problematic introduction added by Burstyn. It was made by a man whose name was anathema to many Catholics, and everyone's worried about communists and atheism taking over the world, particularly American Catholics. They've become very sensitive to what they perceive as atheistic messages, seeing them as entering wedges for communistic thoughts. At any rate, the film opened and all was fine for a few days, until the manager of the Paris Theater was informed by the license commissioner of the city of New York that unless the miracle portion was removed from Ways of Love, the Paris would lose its license. How did the license commissioner come to get involved? The commissioner was a Catholic named Edward McCaffrey, and he'd gotten a call from the Catholic Legion of Decency, a film rating group based in New York City. They suggested that he might want to take a look at what was playing at the Paris. And when he did go to see the movie, he was horrified. He told the theater manager that he considered the film professionally and personally blasphemous. McCaffrey then went to work to get the Motion Picture Division to rescind The Miracle's license. But that didn't work. The censors were statutorily empowered to ban movies if they were sacrilegious. But if there was sacrilege in the movie, the censors didn't see it. They interpreted the movie as more of a story of man's inhumanity to man than a mockery of the virgin birth, as McCaffrey and the Legion of Decency saw it. Burstyn was stunned at McCaffrey's threat. He had a state license. How could a city official step in and cause so much trouble? This really got his dander up. He had a licensed film, an excellent theater. The movie had gotten mostly positive reviews, so Burstyn decided to fight back. He sued, asking for an injunction against McCaffrey's threat to close down the theater, and it worked. The Miracle continued playing at the Paris Theater, but the fireworks were only just beginning. A few days later, the Archbishop of the Diocese of New York, Francis Cardinal Spellman, had a pastoral letter read in every parish church denouncing The Miracle as subversive to the very word of God and an insult to Italian womanhood. Spellman warned Catholics that day that the miracle would, and I quote, divide and demoralize Americans so that the minions of Moscow might enslave this land of liberty, end quote. And he called on all Catholics and all, and I quote, right-thinking Americans to boycott the movie and any theater that dared to show it. This was it. The full brunt of the Catholic Church had fallen on Joseph Burstyn and his movie. Along with official interference from the license commissioner, Burstyn also now had unofficial but incredibly daunting pressure from the leader of New York City's Catholics. That night, pickets showed up in front of the Paris Theater carrying signs like, "Don't enter that cesspool," "Don't look at that filth," and "All the communists are inside." Now, you may be wondering, what does communism have to do with this? Well, Catholics were at the forefront of anti-communism in this early Cold War period because they feared its atheism. In fact, the word godless almost always preceded the word communism in those days. Spellman and McCaffrey saw the miracle as a satire and a mockery of the virgin birth, and to them that meant an opening wedge to atheism. And atheism could be the opening wedge to communism. The Catholic Church today, of course, does not often enter the political arena, but in these Cold War years, it took active roles. Pickets weren't the only problems at the Paris Theater. Inspectors started showing up on a frequent basis, from the fire department, the police department, all looking for minuscule violations as an excuse to shut down the theater. Twice the theater was cleared because of bomb threats. The New York Post smelled a rat. When fire inspectors become film critics, they wrote, "We should all start running for the exits." And the picketers kept coming, arriving every afternoon. One weekend, there were 200 on the sidewalk, and more than 1,000 had volunteered to show up later in the week. Altogether, 15,000 volunteered. In the meantime, film critics and the New York Civil Liberties Union jumped into the fracas. Most critics were infuriated at the Legion of Decency's interference, and the New York Civil Liberties Union was offering assistance to any theater willing to bring a test case of New York censorship law. And they didn't have to look far. Burstyn was their man. And then the Protestant clergy chimed in, many of them speaking out against what they saw as Catholic intimidation. Some prominent clergymen sent the Motion Picture Division a telegram insisting, and I quote, that the Roman Catholic Church has no legal or moral right to attempt to force its views on the state as a whole, end quote. So here's what we've got in January of 1951. Despite the Korean War news, which was all bad, despite the bad economic news, despite the anxiety over a nuclear-armed Soviet Union and world communism, a lot of people in New York City have become obsessed with the content of a 40-minute Italian movie. Critics, Catholics, Protestants, city officials, editorialists, civil libertarians, all battling over whether the miracle should be seen. This little Italian film, made by a Catholic director, starring Catholic actors, untouched by Catholic censors in its homeland, became the football kicked around in a contest of wills in the United States. The miracle came to be the means to an end for both Catholics and civil libertarians, each side intent on using the movie to advance a broader agenda. In late January, about a month after the premiere, Burstyn got some good news, and then he got some bad news. The good news first. New York film critics picked Ways of Love as its best foreign film of 1950. The bad news, Catholic pressure on the censors had become so intense that now it was spilling over onto the Board of Regents, the censors' supervisors. And the regents ambushed Burstyn, ordering him to appear at a show cause hearing 2 weeks later to defend the miracle against sacrilege charges. Now, this show cause hearing was a foregone conclusion, and the regents stripped the miracle of its license in mid-February. All theater screens in New York State were now off limits. Because of the Catholic pressure, the license had been stripped. And Joseph Burstyn took it personally. He'd been opposed to the censors for years back in 1936. He'd dragged them into court over another foreign film. He said, "Every time I have to submit a film for censorship, I feel that I am in an illegitimate business and that being in this business is a crime." Burstyn now thought that he had no choice. Other distributors might have said, "This is too much trouble. I'm going to go find myself another film." But not Joseph Burstyn. He had to bring suit against New York's ban of his film. At the Supreme Court's Appellate Division, which is New York's first level of appellate court, Burstyn and the New York Civil Liberties Union lost. At the Court of Appeals, New York's highest court, Burstyn and the New York Civil Liberties Union lost. So, determined man that he was, he decided to press forward and ask the U.S. Supreme Court to hear his case. Now, the Supreme Court had not heard a case involving motion picture censorship since 1915, when films were in their infancy, long before sound or color or the complex dramas and comedies of the 1930s and 40s, and long before the movement towards cinematic realism in the post-war era. And in that first brush with movies in 1915, the justices of the Supreme Court had decided that movies were not legitimate means of communication. They were, in the words of the court, a business pure and simple, spectacles, they said, just like circuses. So any of the free speech and free press protections of the First Amendment did not apply. The American Civil Liberties Union now stepped in to help Burstyn challenge that idea. Now, you might be wondering, where was Hollywood in all this? The answer is, they were nowhere in the story. They were not interested. The Motion Picture Association of America had accepted censorship for decades. In fact, they were quite happy with it, because it created a stable financial environment for them in which to make profitable movies. It was an insurance policy of sorts against protests from whatever pressure group had an axe to grind over a certain movie. It was like a good housekeeping seal of approval. When Burstyn decided to challenge New York censoring as an interference with the right to communicate, the Motion Picture Association of America just backed away. With the help of an excellent attorney, Ephraim London, and bolstered with amicus support from the ACLU and the American Jewish Congress, Burstyn asked the Supreme Court to find that New York's interference with motion pictures was unconstitutional. The legal argument was a good one, and it hinged on three basic precepts. First, that sacrilege was far too uncertain a term to stand constitutional scrutiny, much too broad, much too vague. Second, that New York's response to the demands of Catholics by suppressing the miracle amounted to an establishment of religion in violation of the First Amendment. And third, that statutory examination of any movie before it could be shown to the public violated the First Amendment's protection on both free speech and free press grounds. Now, these seem like perfectly reasonable arguments to us today, but in 1951, they were a long shot. To defend New York's censorship statute, New York's regents had several time-tested arguments. That the legislature had decided that movies could be dangerous, so the state had the right to regulate them. That it was a necessary protection for the safety and welfare of New Yorkers. And that since the Supreme Court had given its judicial blessing to motion picture censorship way back in 1915, by this point, it had become a long-standing precedent. Now, it's sometimes said that it's not so important that the law is settled correctly than that it's settled. So the court is usually very reluctant to overturn long-standing precedent, particularly if it's one on which current law relies, certainly the case with New York's censoring statute. So stare decisis was in the state's favor. The state also argued that sacrilege was perfectly clear. It didn't need to be defined because everyone knew what it meant. This may also seem perfectly ridiculous to us today, but in 1952, when this case came before the Supreme Court, this was a well-accepted legal doctrine. So, for the court to find in favor of Burstyn, it would have to knock out a 37-year-old precedent on which the laws of several states relied, or find that sacrilege was indeed too vague, or agree that the state's hop-to response in the face of Catholic pressure was indeed an unconstitutional establishment of religion. This was a lot to ask of the 1952 Supreme Court. This court was pretty conservative in terms of protection of civil liberties. When Burstyn and London and the ACLU looked at the justices' voting records from the previous term, they didn't see much to offer any hope. In the previous 5 years, two-thirds of the justices had voted against the claim of a civil rights violation more often than they had voted in favor. And only three had voted to uphold civil rights claims even half the time, a block not nearly big enough to pin any constitutional hopes on. Now, the Supreme Court would come to champion civil liberties in the 1960s, but Burstyn was headed to a very different court in the Red Scare days of 1952, one that in many respects, I must admit, reflected the concerns of the nation, a lot less interested in the rights of the individual like Burstyn, and a lot more interested in protecting the nation from disloyal or threatening behavior, as the Catholics were charging the miracle was. This was a court that had upheld mandatory loyalty oaths, upheld the deportation of an alien because he had briefly flirted with the Communist Party 20 years earlier, and authorized the detention of aliens indefinitely without bail. So, after oral arguments, no one was making any predictions. The answer came on May 26, 1952. It was in favor of Burstyn and the miracle, and it was unanimous. Justice Tom Clark wrote the opinion for the court, and he told New York State that it could no longer censor for sacrilege. That was far too nebulous a term. Looking for sacrilege set the censor, in Clark's words, adrift upon a boundless sea amid a myriad of conflicting currents of religious views, with no charts but those provided by the most vocal and powerful orthodoxies. New York cannot vest such unlimited restraining control over motion pictures in a censor. The state has no legitimate interest in protecting any or all religions, end quote. And then Clark wrote the words that had been eagerly awaited by the opponents of censorship for decades. He wrote, "Expression by means of motion pictures is included within the free speech and free press guarantee of the First and 14th Amendments." So the court had overturned that 1915 decision. So far, all was going Burstyn's way. But then, Clark stopped short of the magic words when he said, "Since the term sacrilegious is the sole standard under attack here, it is not necessary for us to decide whether a state may censor motion pictures under a clearly drawn statute." What had seemed clear had suddenly become very unclear. Movies deserve First Amendment protection, Clark was saying, but not complete protection. Movies had always been seen as different from other media. They had what was called in the time a special capacity for evil. They could be dangerous and did not deserve the same liberties enjoyed by newspapers or books or magazines. So exactly what liberties did movies now enjoy? Well, they were free of being censored for sacrilege, that much was clear. And they could still be censored before being viewed, that was also clear. But that censoring needed to be done under a statute that clearly expressed exactly what the censors were looking for, and the burden of proof was supposed to be shifted to the censors. The censors were henceforth supposed to be the ones to prove that a movie was harmful, rather than the distributor having to prove that his movie was not harmful. In practice, though, this didn't happen until 1965. It would take 13 more years of distributor litigation against censorship. What was perfectly clear to Cardinal Spellman and to the leaders of the Legion of Decency was that their attempt to use the considerable power of the state to silence speech they didn't like didn't work. This was the beginning of the end of the Legion of Decency's domination of film content. And it was a warning shot across the bow of censors in all jurisdictions that their work was now going to be scrutinized by the Supreme Court of the United States. I'd like to tell you that this story had a happy ending for Joseph Burstyn. He was, of course, free to put the miracle back into Ways of Love and play it anywhere he wanted. But if he was hoping for a magic moment when the Supreme Court justices would ride in and smite the censors in true Hollywood fashion, he was surely disappointed. There were lots of plot twists yet to come in the fight against motion picture censorship, but sadly, Burstyn was not around to watch them unfold. Just 1 year after the Supreme Court decision, Burstyn set off on a TWA flight for Paris, but he never got to that year's film festivals. Somewhere over the Atlantic, he was stricken by a coronary thrombosis, and by the time the plane could be set down at Shannon Airport, Burstyn was dead. He was 53. 2 weeks after Burstyn died, New York Times critic Bosley Crowther wrote his weekly column and used it to talk about several more movie censorship cases that were moving up through the courts. He made the column a eulogy for his friend, titling it, "The Case of Burstyn, The Fight on Film Censorship Goes On, in an Honorable Name." Crowther found it strangely fitting that the man who'd been ignored by Hollywood was being ignored in death as well. But Crowther also knew that Burstyn's name would be forever enshrined as a Supreme Court precedent. Burstyn versus Wilson, the case that began, legally, the idea that movie makers should be free to make the movies they wish, and that moviegoers should be free to see what movies they want.